I saw the answers to all of my problems, they'd probably all be solved. Therefore, the way that I need to live is to hold open the door to things that I might not think are true. Because that means the answers probably are something that seem a little weird or a little strange, or just a little wrong.
Welcome back to Religion to Reality. I'm Dave Plisky, your host, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Father John Gribowich. Religion to Reality is the podcast about living an integrated life. In our first season, we unpacked a bunch of data that we got from a study that we did on discipleship in Catholic America. And that took us through a journey with a bunch of guests that told us all about how important listening is. And so for this season, we're spending time with a number of people from all different walks of the faith and religious life in order to be good listeners and recognize what Catholics like us have to hear from people from other faith traditions. Right now, we're in the midst of what I think will end up being a 6-episode arc with Buddhism. This is the third. In our previous episode, we heard from Amy Kisei about finding God in the Zendo. And in this episode, we're going to hear from a Zen priest, Michael McCord, who is also a practitioner of Zen Buddhism. And this was one of our earlier episodes that we recorded in the season, and I had honestly forgotten how rich it is and how deep Michael is thinking and practicing his faith and how well he articulates it, especially to a Christian. I think it's the only episode in the series where the topic of AI comes up. And this is the episode in which finally, and this is, I don't know how many we're in, like, this is must be our 30-somethingth episode total in the podcast. This is the episode in which John finally reveals where our podcast got its name and unpacks that a bit. And I think it's one of those moments in the season where John actually talks for a while, and I think it's a gem. So anyway, without further ado, let's get into this episode. Sozan Michael McCord is the current president of San Francisco Zen Center, where he's been a resident practitioner since 2009. Over the years, he's held a number of leadership roles across the organization, including director of City Center in the Beginner's Mind Temple and chief financial officer. Earlier in his practice, he served as Eno, which is head of the meditation hall, and Tenzo, which is head cook at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. Michael was ordained as a Zen priest by Ryushin Paul Holler in 2014. Before coming to Zen, he worked in both the technology and financial sectors. He also holds a BA in theology from Ambassador University and spent time volunteering in Amman, Jordan with the Ambassador Foundation, where he helped provide vocational training for individuals with developmental disabilities. His path has woven together spiritual practice, service, and organizational leadership, grounded in a deep commitment to the teachings of Soto Zen. So thank you so much for being here. It's a fascinating background, and I'd love to learn more about you and, you know, what you're thinking about right now with the context that we've provided.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. I have, known you, John, for a few years. John attended our, Young Urban Zen group several times, and that's where we struck up a conversation. I think some of the questions that we were asking there and why that group specifically is our most, I would say, well-attended and vibrant group on a Tuesday night in the middle of the week, you know, more than 100 people with over 3,000 members pack into our Buddha Hall. And a lot of them are 20 to 40 years old. We're right here in the middle of everything tech. So most of them are working for all the companies you can think of. And they were the best and the brightest from somewhere on the planet. And they got the job and several years in realized that they still felt the same way they felt when they were 15, or they still were struggling with the same thing they've been struggling with all their life. And this didn't solve anything, getting the job that they always wanted. And so what we've been looking at is Zen as a practice is supposed to be a 24/7 practice, the way that all religions are supposed to be, supposed to, intended to be, however you want to put it, but that it's, you know, you wouldn't say that you put down the mantle of Christ when you leave the church. You know, you're supposed to have that on the bus and in your relationships and everywhere else. But how does that tangibly live when you're a software engineer or you're a company founder, or and you're just in the midst of the capitalistic machine and being asked to give everything you've got, and your ego's being rewarded for it if you do, and your bank account. And so, you know, the thing that we have, as far as I think our next frontier that overlaps so clearly with what you're asking here, is how does a practice, ours is 13th century Japan, and then before that, you know, going back all the way to India, but how does a 13th century Japanese set of rituals and practices translate to someone who is just living the modern life? And that's what I'd like to unpack with you, tell you what we're doing, and I'm very curious to hear what you have heard.
Yeah, great.
Well, you know, Michael, I think one way to kind of get this set up for us as well is for you to just unpack your own personal journey, because I know that I have, the first time I heard you speak at Young Urban Zen, I was like, oh, I really feel like this guy already speaks a common language. And it wasn't necessarily the language of Zen necessarily that I was connecting with, which I would say I recognize that language a lot better now, but I could tell that you came from the Christian tradition. And when we start to talk, I was like, oh, you have a very unique experience with what that is and how you've lived it, what you want to give your life to, and also just really the disappointments and the rude awakenings that happen as you kind of try to follow that path. So I don't know if you're comfortable unpacking a little bit of that, because I think that really sets the stage for what is happening right now with a lot of people who have been exposed to Christianity through just culture or through growing up that way, and now reaching a point where it's like, something is disconnecting here. This is not engaging the way yeah. that I thought it was going to. And to me, I don't really even think of what you've done as being like, okay, I'm done with this now. Now I'm doing this. It seems to be like a deepening of your journey. And that's the thing that I'm most attracted to. So I don't know if you can sure. unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, growing up in a family that was very conservative Christian in kind of a unique non-denominational church called the Worldwide Church of God, they held a lot to respect for the Jewish faith and the Old Testament law. They kind of viewed a lot of their theology through the lens of the Jews have the understanding of the law, but somehow they miss the Savior. And so that would be maybe a very reductive way of talking about that church. And they were very conservative. They were in a lot of countries, had about 150,000 members. And my parents were really very involved in, you know, activities, volunteering, and it was a big part of our life. When I was a young teen, I had a brother who died of cancer, and my family was having a lot of difficulties, and I had a youth pastor that I really identified with, that his warmth, his understanding, and I just wanted to be like Phil Rice, my youth minister. And he had gone to this college called Ambassador College, and I joined Spokesman's Club or Toastmasters when I was 15. I wanted to be a minister and started doing public speaking, training really learning, reading the Bible, knowing history, and went to their college. Right about the time I was going to the college, though, the founder of the church died, and they started changing the theology just a little bit here and a little bit there. And I was 3 years into doing the coursework, and they were headquartered in Los Angeles with a sister campus in Texas. And I was in the Texas campus, and they had these projects around the world you could go on and volunteer. And so I went to the Middle East and studied a lot of Islam so that I could be a part of the community, a lot of Arabic. And I was working under the auspices of one of the princesses of Jordan. We knew the royal family, and Princess Sarvat and her husband, the crown prince, Prince Amrad bin Prince, no, it wasn't Rod bin Zayd. I forget her husband's name. But anyway, he was the crown prince. And these folks were, the way they were serving their country was really admirable to me. And I wouldn't call them incredibly steeped in religion as far as just being having a lot of black and white. And I came from a place where our church, at least, was quite black and white in regard to what was the truth, who had the truth, how you should live. You know, feminism was wrong. No one was gay. And I saw, this whole other culture. And my church was changing the religion and the theology at the time here and there. And I can remember coming back from there and stopping off for just 2 weeks in Paris, France, and staying with some friends that were loosely associated with my church and having a whole other experience where people were asking me questions just like they were in the Middle East. Because in the Middle East, unlike America, when you first get into a cab or you first get into a conversation with a stranger, the first thing they do is ask you about religion and politics. You know, Michael, what do you think of the Jews? Michael, what do you think of, you know, American foreign policy? What do you think, you know, what do you think of whatever? You know, it's just like, and all day long, I was this 21-year-old kid and I had to take cabs everywhere and getting interviewed by people who had been, you know, in some cases living in the Bekaa Valley as a refugee or, you know, caught up in the turmoil of wars and really engaged in politics. And I realized how much I was just a product of my own culture, that I really didn't know why I thought what I thought, that all of my responses were things someone had told me the way the world was, and I had not really touched what the world was. I hadn't been out there. And my experience in Paris, France was the same way. I can remember being at a card game with a bunch of kids who loosely identified as Christians. And in the background, there was some Arnold Schwarzenegger Total Recall movie going on. And then we were playing cards. And around 10 o'clock at night, at least at that time in the early 90s, all three of the main government channels in Paris, France, had porn on them. And it wasn't something in society that was thought of as, you know, something that could just be on TV. So here I am, a Christian kid, and porn is now going on in the background, and I get a little uncomfortable. And I said, wait a second, shouldn't we change the channel? This is making me, and this French woman my age named Genevieve, she says, you are such a hypocrite. And I'm like, what? She says, you will sit here for 3 hours and watch blood and bullets and violence and hatred, and your morality doesn't get up. And then all of a sudden, you know, you see sex and now your morality is up. And I went back to my church college after the experience, and they had changed even more theology. And I was asked to be a person managing their call center. I'm one of the managers where the 800 number for the church's television program, and they were changing the theology. So a lot of people were calling in and asking people to explain the new theology. And I wasn't sure about any of it. So I got my degree, really unclear about what this was, really, who am I? What do I think? And people can just have a weekend meeting and change like what we said we were going to die for. And like, wait a second. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I had nothing. I wanted nothing to do with organized religion. I was angry. I was angry at Christianity. I was angry at organized religion in general. I kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater and just took a job answering phones at a tech company in Denver and started to work my way up, taught myself to program, eventually became a product manager, helped found a tech company in India, and terrible timing in 2000, 2001. We all lost our money and I moved to Seattle. And I always wanted to live there. I had a deep love of poetry and spoken word, and I basically shaved my head and grew a mustache and goatee and read on the open mic circuit my poetry, surrealist, anarchist, slam poetry, conventional poetry, improv poetry, and that's what I basically did for the next year and a half, and didn't work, trying to find what I wanted to find. I did have some friends at Microsoft, and I went to the Microsoft company party in 2002, and we were walking around, and they always have these, you know, they pay for a huge band that everybody knows to come in, and world famous folks, and they had this one apparently world famous fortune teller, and they said, we should go get our fortunes told, and I'm like, oh, that's this crazy stuff, but I went in, we had, you know, this little session with a fortune teller, and she looked at my palm, and she said, you were going down a very spiritual path, but you had a crisis. And then you moved into something where now you're making a lot of money. But then something happened there and you're in limbo. And you can go back to what it is you were doing and make a lot of money. And you will make a lot of money, but not much will happen for you. But if you go back to the spiritual path, there will be a oak tree that children can swing off of. And it was just like, you know, it just hit me. And I completely ignored the advice because it was a fortune teller. And I started actually working at Citigroup because I met this guy in Seattle who was one of the top people on the West Coast for Citi. And I loved the way he worked. And he reminded me of my youth pastor, actually. He's one of these people that could really kick your behind, but you still just knew that they cared about you. And so I joined. They moved me to San Francisco. I became his right-hand man. And within a few years, I was managing retail lending for all the Bay Area. And that was right around the time the financial crisis was happening. And I was looking for a way to calm like the busy mind. Eventually I had Greg's job. He was now the competitor. I was just like, now this is just a job and working at a global financial institution. So I started going to San Francisco Zen Center to meditate. And it had nothing to do with the religion, the bowing, the altars, the ritual, the whatever. And slowly I started to see that this was incredibly practical. And it wasn't something that just lived in the temple. And there came an opportunity to be paid to leave, and I took it and spent a year volunteering at San Francisco Zen Center, living in the community and volunteering in a lot of other places. And eventually I went to Tassajara, which was the first Zen training monastery outside of Asia, founded in 1969, and went there to do a three-month stint to kind of do a deep dive, thinking I was going to go back to tech or finance. And every day, about these 3 month deep dives, you get up at 3:50 in the morning, you're living off the grid, no heat, and you know, 6 to 9 hours of meditation a day, a lot of classes, and you're kind of learning the old world kind of Zen practices where they would do them in the mountains of Japan. And I really took to it, and I just kept signing up to do it over and over again. During the 3 month stint, you don't get to leave. You're 13 miles from society. Really a deep dive where you just have like your robes, your bowl, and you know, your bed. And I found it very freeing and very liberating. And it started dawning on me how much this stuff applies to the finance world and the tech world and to where people are really living. And every summer, the monastery turns into a bit of a resort where we make our money, and the monks kind of serve people that come there who want to go to the hot springs and that kind of thing. And this Zen group from, a lot of them are Zen groups that come there, and a Zen group from Silicon Valley came, the Mountain View Sangha. I started talking to them and to their abbot, and there was such a connection. And everything that I was saying was really resonating with these people, and they really wanted to know more. And so they invited me to come and give a talk at the Mountain View Zen Center called Canon Do. And that was the beginning of me realizing, maybe this is what I want to do. So I did ordain as a priest after about 5 years. And then I came back to San Francisco in 2016, where the headquarters is, and started working for the administration and living in the city center temple here, and also serving the San Francisco community as a priest. And so I've just been working here in San Francisco and helping to lead Young Urban Zen. I do outside coaching for all sorts of people, sometimes as a priest and sometimes just working with Zen principles in their modern workday. Do a lot of partnerships with other groups here in the city, but largely trying to help people understand the number one thing, which is how Zen can live where they are, and not something where you have to hold your breath all week long so you can get back to the place and meditate and exhale and recuperate so you can go back to the crazy job. If that's what it is, then Zen is just a weekend hobby, but it's not really alive. And that's kind of what my main passion is now, is to talk to people who were in the positions I was in previously and tell them how it can live where they are.
Wow. That was a lot and really good. Thank you for sharing that. That's your journey. I'm left thinking about, in your Christian days, you were thinking about truth, and it was challenging you because people were asking you what you believe, and because the belief itself seemed to be changing, in your church context and in your college context. Yeah. And what I'm picking up now, and tell me if I'm hearing this right, that for you, it's like Zen is true because it applies to everyday life, that it's not about like learning truth. It's about having a practice that allows you to go deeper and to be better. Is that?
Yeah. And to add to that, my teacher that I really connected with early on at Zen Center, Paul Haller, was a former Catholic altar boy from Ireland. And he had in his youth thrown out the baby with the bathwater too, and then come back around to realizing that there was something really there and valuable and powerful in his early affinity with the Catholic Church. And he formed a partnership with Brother David Standel Rast. I don't know if you've heard of him, but I think he's a Benedictine monk, or is it Franciscan?
Yeah, he's a Benedictine. Mm-hmm.
They used to teach a workshop at Tassajara in the summer on the overlap between the religions, and how that really at the highest level, the mystics that are, whether they be Muslim or Jewish or Christian or Buddhist, are saying the same things. And he helped me to learn not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I came around to having a much deeper appreciation and respect for what I originally was called to. I believe that essentially, if a religion can't be practiced 24/7, it's not actually a religion. And so I think that all the major religions can be. It's just a matter of how they're being engaged.
And my only other question from your story is, I just have to ask, what do you, looking back now, and I could tell that it still impacts you, what do you make of the fortune teller experience?
Well, For me, I hold it the same way I hold a lot of the bigger questions, just kind of like with a question mark. I don't know. I know there's a heck of a lot that science can't explain. I know that there is a lot that religion hasn't explained as far as specificity and detail. There could be something there, you know. There's so many things that we don't understand as far as collective consciousness and all the different potential realities that people have said that you could, you know, postulate through string theory. Who knows exactly what's going on? There's a thing that, you know, a story someone asks the Buddha, why are we here? What happens when we die? And the Buddha says in a very Buddhist way, that's not the question. And it's not that it's a bad question to have. It's just that the question of Zen is a lot about who's the person in front of me and what's the moment asking for and how am I going to meet the moment in a skillful way. And then being open-minded to, there's a lot that I don't know. And so you come across phenomenon like that. And it is powerful. You realize, you know, did I need to go down the path of having a career in finance first? You know, maybe I did. Or maybe I was just too closed-hearted and closed-minded to really accept the fact that maybe a fortune teller was tapping into something. You know, I don't know.
It's so fun hearing your story, Michael, I guess maybe in light of my own journey and the way you're talking now is like, I feel like I'm more Zen than I am Christian, but that's not really a true statement just simply because I feel as if Zen practice enables me to encounter the very living presence of Christ in everything. But I think, you know, for me, Zen is so much about the experience, meaning that this is what enables us to live and to live well, because we're having an experience of what it is that allows us to be. I don't know if that even makes sense, but so much of Christianity gets kind of caught up in just learning about what it is that allows us to be rather than actually somehow entering into that very experience of what allows us to be. And, you know, just from your own background, I mean, where do you personally, I know that you probably have heard a lot of things in interreligious types of contexts, but for you personally, where do you see the convergence or the complementarity of, say, the Christian worldview and Zen practice? What does that look like for you, or what do you think it could look like for someone?
Yeah, you know, I think that the fundamental pieces of Christianity are touching on things that are touching the divine, that are they're touching the thing that people define in a lot of different ways. You know, I would say that, you know, you start with John 8:32, you shall know the truth and the truth will set you free. You know, so what is know and what is truth? And, you know, this overlaps into, you know, all of Greek philosophy, you know thyself and nothing too much. You know, and so there's a certain knowing. You can't really know the truth until you know yourself. You have to be relating the truth to something. Through some sort of a lens. And if you are looking at, you know, Buddhist philosophy, you're essentially looking at the Four Noble Truths, which have to do, they start with suffering. And, you know, the fact that everyone suffers. And then why do we suffer? Because we are essentially bound by our grasping and our clinging, our sense of things being permanent, the sense of not wanting things to change. Building these stone castles in our minds for the ways that things are, and then working through the release of that grasp of this is the only way things can be, this is whatever. And that my desire, my clinging is what's going to need to be let go of. So even just starting with John 8:32, you're looking at essentially winding up with the goal of freedom. And the Buddhism uses the term liberation. You could use freedom in the exact same way, that they're more than just synonyms. They're kind of saying the same thing, that this is a pathway for humans not to suffer. And I think when you start there, it's the same thing. Going further is where you start to unpack it into other areas. And I'll just pause there.
I think that, you know, maybe it's helpful just from your perspective to just talk about Zen for a bit. Like, it's a word we're throwing around a lot. I don't know how familiar people are who are listening to this as to really what we mean or what you may mean when you say Zen. And I know that it can mean a lot of things to everyone, and it should mean something unique to every individual, I guess you would say. But loosely, how would you describe that? How would you describe Zen?
And let me just add to that, and how it might relate to other, you know, forms of Buddhism might be helpful.
Sure, sure. Yeah, so Zen would be a form of a school. Maybe not a school. It would be a form of Buddhism, a practice that is a Buddhist practice. And then the form of the school of Zen that I practice is the Soto school, which is probably the most prevalent one in the North America. The Zen would be, in my definition, the phenomenon of the universe. It is the phenomenon of what's happening right now. And so the Dharma, or the teachings of Zen, would be the teaching that's in every moment as the phenomena is manifesting and unfolding. This is why sometimes there's a misconception about Zen, that Zen is about being neither high nor low and not moving too fast. Just almost the verb Zen, as you see it in the modern vernacular, being kind of passive in some sort of way. Zen as a practice would be meeting the moment of what the universe is offering in that moment, and having the awareness. Well, first it would be having the grounding and the settledness of spirit to have the opportunity to be aware of what the moment is offering. And then to have the practice so that there is willingness of spirit to actually do what the moment is asking for, even if it is maybe not what I'm inclined to do. So kind of moving from a grounding, grounding practices, grounding rituals, settled things that settle the spirit into awareness, so that a person can essentially be a gift to the world. And not in this school wouldn't be seeking their own enlightenment. Enlightenment might happen, but practicing for other people, practicing essentially cleaning up my side of the street so that, you know, I can not be as bound with my own baggage and better able to understand how to meet other people. So this would be at the most basic level, how Zen would be, you know, defined. And so it would not be, you know, shying away from enjoying things. In Zen, people can get married, they could have sex, they could enjoy having a great meal, they could enjoy going to a great concert. It would just be that, you know, I always say to the students, just think of Zen and clinging and grasping and desire the same way you think of eating your cookies. And when you're eating your cookie, just thoroughly enjoy that it's cookie time. And you know that sometime before cookie 14, it quit being cookie time. And being able to let go of even an enlightened moment Like, I want to get back to that place I was sitting last week where I was just in this place of concentrated bliss. It's like, well, that's great, but that's what was happening then. The purpose of sitting isn't to attain bliss. The purpose of sitting is to allow the things in you to come forward so that you can see them, and you're creating a more and more settled state, kind of like an archaeological dig. And so 30 years in, you might have something come forward, and for a week or two, you might have really difficult, awful, disturbing sits that you just feel unnerved. But that thing that's coming for you and coming through you and trying to be seen, no way it could have come forward 30 years ago. You know, you wouldn't have been able to handle it. It's kind of like living into the capacity to see truth. And so these would be kind of the core pieces of Buddhism in the Zen school, as I would describe them.
And how does that differ from the other forms of Buddhism that maybe came before or even since?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that was really different that I think helped Zen flourish in North America and Europe and other parts of the world is that in the 19th century, there was a lot of things that unfolded where people were going to lose their land. And there was a huge backlash against anything ancient. Japan had opened itself to the world, and it found that in a lot of different ways it was behind in some of the sciences and other areas. And a knee-jerk reaction happened in the mid to late 19th century, where people wanted to just get rid of all this stuff and move on and study science and get better with, you know, all the modern stuff. And the way that a lot of things happened with people wanted to go after the wealth of the monasteries and go after the wealth of the properties. And the only way that you could, by the laws that changed, pass on wealth and land was through heredity. And because monks couldn't marry, then they were looking at maybe the end of their religion. They changed it just out of sheer practicality, and were Zen is one of the few schools where people who are priests get married, have families, and in a lot of the other schools, most of the other schools, that's not the case. I think that can really be quite helpful. There's various schools that are stricter or harsher around, eating meat. San Francisco Zen Center is vegetarian, but we're not vegan. That upsets some vegans. I myself actually try to be vegan, but it's more because of an understanding of the environment. It's actually one of the key ways that's been listed for one person to have a less of a greenhouse footprint on the environment. But San Francisco Zen Center is, for instance, vegetarian. And yet if you go to places in Nepal and Tibet, where it's very hard to grow vegetables and very hard to grow things, and people have been living off of goats and yaks and what have you for millennia, a lot of the practices there, people will eat meat. So there's a certain practical nature to Buddhism. One of the things that's interesting is that it's called Buddhism because it was largely named by people who were colonists who were from Europe, who were going all around Asia in the 16th and 17th, 18th centuries, and didn't really know what to call all these different religions. But the thing that they had in common was the Buddha. So they just called it Buddhism. But as things spilled out of the Indo-Gangetic plain into South Korea or Korea and into Thailand and Ceylon and the Sri Lanka and, you know, China became Chan Buddhism. Then it went to, you know, every single culture it went to, it morphed and changed. Because as a you know, Nietzsche was very famously down on religion. But one thing he did say positive, if he said, you know, he said, one thing I can say is that at least with Buddhism at its core, in order to stay relevant, it recognizes that it has to change, that there isn't like a thing that like this is always the way it will be in regard to the way it's practiced. So, you know, in India, the people were gurus, and you went to the wise man and you saw the guru, and they didn't do any work. Their job was to be in the temple, to see people, to talk about things, to think about things. As soon as Buddhism goes from India to China, it encounters Taoism, which was way pre-Buddhist. And they had a strong work ethic, like everyone works. In fact, some of those documents are where the statement, you know, a day without work is a day without eating. Just like in principle, like if I'm going to eat, I'm going to work. And so everyone worked, you know, all the priests worked, and then work practice got infused into Buddhism, especially through the Chan school. And it still isn't largely in India and in some other places. You know, it goes to Japan and it encounters Shintoism and kind of like a Mother Earth Wiccan sort of way of viewing the world. So you go to Japan and probably 90%+ of the people consider themselves Buddhist. Probably 100% of them consider themselves Shinto. And they don't see a conflict. So on the back of, you know, Zen altars, you'll find a water god. And we're like, what's that? That's not really Buddhist. And it's just, it comes directly out of like the Shinto religion. So I think that, you know, the Dalai Lama really put it well when somebody asked him one time, I think it was Dan Rather was interviewing him, and said, you know, there's just so many great practical principles of Buddhism. Maybe everyone should just be a Buddhist. And without hesitating, he said, no, if someone has a spiritual practice and it's working well for them, that's what they should stick with. And it really made a point to me that, you know, this wasn't a destination religion of, okay, we're going to try to turn everyone Buddhist. It was a more way of saying, look, these principles through the Buddhist framework are really powerful for people if they step into it. But it's not to say that it's exclusive. And so that's why you'll find so much variation between, there's some Korean Zen organizations. There's one in the East Bay in Oakland. It might be the biggest Buddhist group in the Bay Area. I think they've got over 2,000 people attend their services. You'd be hard pressed to notice the difference in how they practice between a Christian Protestant church. It looks very down that path, and sitting meditation. It's about service and giving up offerings and talking about experience. And I think there's a lot of different schools. Between the Zen, the Rinzai school focuses a lot more on koan study and the ambiguous sort of story you chew on, even though we study those in Soto as well. So I think you'll find a lot of variety in regard to how the religion is practiced. I think it's the Nepalese. They get up in the morning and they have a huge compassion practice, and they realize that compassion is something that has to be cultivated, and they will chant for 2 hours and do like a wake up like compassion practice just to get the day started. You know,
what would that compassion practice look like, or just what are some that you understand as being?
Yeah. Typical? Memorizing things like the loving kindness meditation, this is what should be accomplished by the one who is wise, who seeks the good and has obtained peace. Let one be strenuous, upright and sincere, without pride, easily contented and joyous. And it just goes through all these different pages of how one should be, and then how one should manifest to the world as far as just being open. And even as a mother at the risk of her life gives and watches over her only child, should one be to all living beings, and you know, all this sort of ways of taking metaphor and visual imagery and wishing this to the world. And if there's conflict between you and someone else, you might sit before an altar for an hour and with their picture on it and like wish them well, you know, and realizing that the human heart might want to be compassionate, might want to be open. But let's face it, if you've been doing production, which is what the world asks of us, and you're have a busy day and doing all sorts of stuff, it's very easy to have a calloused heart. And so these are the things that are taken up in different ways of emphasis in the different cultures that Buddhism has spread to.
I sometimes hear people characterize Buddhism more as a philosophy than as a religion. And you always refer to it as a religion. And that was my understanding too. Would you say that it's the practices, both personal and communal, that kind of take it from being merely a philosophy into being a religion? And would you say that if that's the case, is it a dangerous thing for someone to only kind of accept the theory, so to speak, and not the practice?
Yeah. Just to answer the last question, and I'll work backward. I would say that in general, there's an author, Stephen Batchelor, who wrote a book on Buddhism Without Beliefs, that is really interesting. You know, if someone has a practice that is steeped in Catholicism or Judaism, and it's really working for them, there's no reason why they can't use some of the Buddhist principles of meditation or some of the Buddhist principles of grounding to help their life, you know. And I think that, you know, Buddhism steals from a lot of different, you know, religions in regard to things that we found to be, you know, incredibly useful. The philosophy or religion is really funny. I've been asked that question so many times that it's one of the first things whenever I got my hands years ago on my first AI tool, I typed it in there just to see what the tool would say to me. And I really liked it.
I mean, the fact that you're a priest, right? Like that's a signal right there. You know, yeah. I don't think, but sorry.
No, I really liked its answer. It was exactly what I believe. I think it's both. I think it can be practiced as both. Its core is definitely a religion. Loose way of describing a religion would be something that is transformative, that is respecting something that is beyond pragmatism. So, you know, it's asking you to hold things that you would find maybe in disbelief because you are accepting the fact that I might not be the highest thing in the universe. And so there's truths that I need to live into. And that that it has a framework for working through down that path, and that there is a transcendent quality of not knowing where you will end up, but willing to live into it, and holding open the questions of cosmology, why we came here. How we came to be, what is the purpose of man, what happens when we die, that those questions are, held as relevant. But the religion part of it that I think is, to me, the definition has to do with the touching of the divine. And whether people want to call that God or the being in alignment with the universe or what have you, there is something that's here that is beautiful, that is a powerful, and it can be touched and being, it can be used to transform. Anything that's going down that path, I think, is a religion. But the practices themselves, I think, are incredibly powerful. And if somebody intends to practice it as a philosophy, I have nothing against it. And I don't think that, I think it might, personally, I think it might limit what could possibly be seen. But I would not want them to not go down that path because maybe they have too fixed a preconceived notion about what religion is. And it would keep them from actually entering into something that could be transformative.
You know, what you're saying just makes me think about just the title of the podcast, Religion to Reality. And that originated actually from an Eastern Orthodox thinker, Alexander Shamon. And he made this argument that Christianity, Christ himself, was the embodiment of the end of all religion. Because in the sense of religion suggests or kind of requires even a distance between that which is divine and oneself, and that relationship between the divine and the self is the place where religious practice starts to take a place where one needs to appease, let's say, the God, or be able to kind of receive the presence of God in one's life. However, that transactional sense that religion seems to traditionally be, you know, and he writes that, Shamon writes that when it comes to Christ, there is no distinction. Well, there's distinction, but there is a wholeness of humanity and divinity. And that the wholeness now kind of removes the separation between God and the human person, the human being. And I think about that because that would be reality. Like, what does it mean to be a complete participant in the very essence of the divine at all times, in all places, in all spaces? And that your awareness of that is what allows you to be, allows you to understand maybe even just the fact that your life is not your own, as many Christian theologians would kind of suggest based on like the theology of St. Paul. I mean, how does that just like sit with you? I'm sorry, I'm just kind of thinking this through as I speak, but like, how does that sit with you in your practice? And like, and what Zen means to you, you know?
Yeah, no, that's very aligned, actually, with the core Buddhist teaching that, you know, the process of enlightenment in Buddhism is not something that you are gaining from without. It is a process of unveiling. And so the Buddha taught that, you know, everyone is Buddha. That, you know, everyone has like that Buddha nature. Everyone is a Buddha, if you will. And that he was just one in a line of Buddhas. And that for each person, their process of unpacking their suffering, their craving, their grasping is essentially getting in touch with the fact that to have one moment of consciousness takes millions and billions of causes and conditions to align. And the fact that there is a human being that does have consciousness is the sign of something that is quite miraculous. So there is already a great alignment with the universe just by being alive and being a human. And that the individual suffering, the process is to unveil that Buddha nature that's inside, that alignment with the universe is all of my stories, my narratives, my fears, my ego, all the things that are keeping me from actually seeing truth and seeing what it is that's keeping me back is what my pathway is to let go of those things. So, you know, the fact that there wouldn't be separation between the divine and a human, would be what, you know, I experience as the core of the Buddhist, you know, view of what humans are doing.
Yeah, I mean, in the Christian tradition, it's the whole essence of kenosis, you know, of this self-emptying, like allowing yourself to become divine, really. I mean, this whole sense that, you know, in the very person of Jesus Christ, one sees what one's whole life is through birth, death, rebirth, and the whole cycle, right? And that, you know, one is able to allow themselves to be set free of their own need for control, their own need for their own self-identification, whatever it may be, to realize that they participate in something far greater than they could ever possibly orchestrate. But that participation is also inherently unique to the individual. So it's not as if they just are getting taken away and becoming like nothing, and they just, their life is just the same as any other life. It's that there's inherent uniqueness to each person that allows the full mosaic of the cosmos to exist. And that mosaic really right there is the wholeness of the interconnectivity of that which is human and that which is divine, which is one and the same. I don't know if I'm really kind of maybe saying it in a clear way, but like, I just think that, to me, my experience, my personal experience with Zen practice has enabled me to live that reality better than anything I've ever experienced within, say, Christian devotional practice. And I'm not saying it's not possible. And trust me, I've done a lot of things in Christian devotional practice, from rote prayers to charismatic experiences to just modes of meditation, Lectio Divina, different types of things. But this 24/7, so to speak, practice of attentiveness and awareness to what is, to me, affirms my identity as a beloved child, let's just say, of God, if we're going to use that kind of language, and also how my role is completely unique and is indispensable because of the fact that I fit into the whole, as it is for the person next to me, and as it is for the tree in front of me, and as it is for the bird in the sky. You know, I mean, I was just revisiting Thomas Merton's Zen and the Birds of Appetite, and I was like thinking, here's like a more modern way to try to show how this is a very beautiful complementarity of how to live life. And it transcends, in a certain sense, how you want to think about the world, because it's really what is. And once again, it's religion to reality. It's what is. It's not necessarily trying to be outside of reality and try to think about it. It's just what is. So I don't know. I don't know if this is helping or making it more confusing, but it's just what's coming to my mind as we're talking this through. I don't know, Dave, maybe you can kind of maybe parcel it all out better.
Don't hit it off to me. I want to hear what Michael says.
Okay. I mean, but I don't know if that's helpful for a comment.
I think you characterized it really well. I can affirm what you're saying. You know, obviously we're coming from the same tradition, but it feels to me like what you're touching on is, if it's true, it's always true, right? It doesn't matter what tradition we approach it through. That's why we call it the perennial tradition. And I feel like, I don't want to add to it, actually. I just want to hear what Michael has to say. I just want to say, yes, I think you characterized
it. I was just hoping that, I didn't know if there was something that could have been said better. Anyway.
Yeah. I think that, what you said was beautiful. I think that there's really nothing there that would be in conflict or in saying something different than what I think Buddhism is saying in general. There's something that's a little framed a little differently and held a little differently in Buddhism, which is holding the word truth a little bit more lightly in regard to there being kind of ultimate truth and there being a kind of a conventional truth, if you will. This is a fairly kind of exhaustive subject, so I'm trying to narrow this down a little bit. But if you were to, let's say, be standing in the Grand Canyon at night and you'd never been in the Grand Canyon before and it was dark and you're at the very basin floor and someone gave you a flashlight and it was just your regular flashlight and you started to look around, you're like, oh, look at, yeah, you start seeing, you know, and you have a certain truth. The truth is also tied to awareness because things exist within context. You know, if you take things out of context, oftentimes they mean different things. You take one sentence out of your favorite book and you place it down in some different graphic novel, it means something else. Unless your favorite book is a graphic novel, and then we go the other direction to, you know, Dickens or whatever. But, you know, so you, if you're in that Grand Canyon and then someone gives you, you know, a floodlight, you know, after 10 years of practice, you start to get a sense inside of, oh, wait a second, there's a lot more to see here. And so the way that you're holding truth is understanding the truth from the human perspective is being talked about from a context. And that context is limited by awareness. And so there is ultimate truth. Oftentimes it's something that Buddhism would hold ultimate truth as something that is a little bit more far reaching and a little more rare to actually, touch on. There can be conventional truths, but as anyone knows from living in, you know, a family, try to get siblings to agree on how mom was, or try to get, four friends to all agree on how a fifth person is, you know. And they're all being very sure that of what they saw, what they, you know, and that's why, you know, trial attorneys just, you know, live for this stuff, because what we hold as truth can be dangerous because we're all coming from a lens and from a context. And so in the Buddhist practice, we talk a little bit more about truth with a small t. Not as though we're trying to just go to the other extreme, which, you know, folks are always worried about with religion, which is, you know, everything's true and everyone's right. And it's like, well, you can say that and there's also consequences. You know, you can play out anything that you think is a truth, you know. But there's a lot I could probably say on the subject, but I think that Buddhism would hold things a little loosely around the subject of truth, while at their darndest trying to touch on what is the truth of the situation, what is the reality of the thing that's in front of me. Trying to, I guess you'd say, the approach being pragmatic, but the theory being kind of transcendent, you know, that it's you know, to start down a spiritual path. And let's say I'm at point A and I want to go down a spiritual path. The very thing that I am making a plan for planning to go down a spiritual path, I'm planning with a mind that has not been down that spiritual path. So therefore it is inherently limited by the fact that I'm the one planning it. So there has to be this subject of faith in regard to the fact that there's things that I will think are true that I'm going to have to let go of. And so it's kind of setting up the fact that, if I saw the answers to all of my problems, they'd probably all be solved. So therefore, the way that I need to live is to hold open the door to things that I might not think are true, because that means the answers probably are something that seem a little weird or a little strange or just a little wrong. Now, it doesn't mean I need to digest everything that is open, but it's kind of holding it the way that, you know, the American revolutionary Thomas Paine held things, where he said that the measure of a person's intellect is the scope of what they can entertain without having to digest it. And so it's just kind of keeping that door open, knowing that my awareness is limited. And what I think is true today is going to evolve if I'm going down the spiritual path, but not to say that there isn't ultimate truth.
That's great. That's, I mean, you're, to me, you're describing non-dualism in a really healthy way. So that, that was helpful. You mentioned a number of times, you kind of said that part of what Zen is trying to do is to make someone better, but not for the sake of enlightenment, but actually for the sake of serving others and to be able to be attentive to them and available to the moment, especially in the case of when you are, you know, kind of face-to-face with another person. And you mentioned, human beings a few times, but I also know that in a lot of forms of Buddhism, there's a great emphasis on not just the dignity of humanity, but also the dignity of animals and nature and all that kind of stuff. And so I wanted to take the, where I want to step that to somehow bridge this to is the question of consciousness, which has also come up a few times in our conversation. And you are sitting in San Francisco, you know, working with tech folks all the time. And I feel like the nexus of the conversation around consciousness these days has to do with, you know, non-human consciousness, what, you know, where AI is going and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm trying to sit here, thinking what I think without judgment about this type of stuff. And I wondered if you think that there is something we can learn from the tech, I don't want to say the tech bros, but the technocrats, I guess we'll just call it, about consciousness that you think can inform healthy religion in some way.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite subjects. And as you can imagine, it's one that we turn over all the time. I teach a workshop called Being Human in the Age of AI. And, you know, you go back to the Philip K. Dick novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which eventually became Blade Runner. Humans and robots eventually, you know, you can't tell the difference between the two of them. And in that novel that was based on, you know, the humans eventually developed this religion, and the religion, or each human in their apartment had a box, and they would put their head in this box, and they would see essentially a hologram of an old man going up a hill, and he'd be getting beaten with rocks. And the person with looking at the old man would feel through whatever science they were using, they would feel the pain of the old man. And it was called the empathy box. And it was realizing that that there was something about the beating heart of now and being concerned in a way that is altruistic and not a gaining idea that is something that's incredibly human. And what this does is it makes people right now, and this is a question I ask a lot of students, and what we focus on is, you know, okay, this is actually a really good context for religion, because now you can see the fact that no matter how smart you are, no matter how well you can produce things, you are going to be overtaken if it's just about production. If it's just about you showing up and producing things, you're going to be overtaken, even with art, you know. So what is it that is unique about your beating heart? What is it that you attach to that is maybe completely inefficient, but that can be given back to the universe? And helping people, largely people who were, you know, the best and the brightest from around the world at producing things, understanding things, and what have you, leaning into, oh, wow, this isn't the thing that makes me unique, you know? And the thing that makes me unique has nothing to do with, you know, my company I just founded, or how I'm smarter than, you know, most other people. It's like, yeah, and that's, if you can do something like that and give a gift back to the world, then great. But the bodhisattva vow, as we call it in Buddhism, which is the vow to be here and practicing so that you help others, is a sort of vow that is inefficient and that a machine would never come to as the logical thing to do. And yet, it is the thing that feeds the heart. It is the thing that helps humanity be greater than the sum of its parts, to coalesce, if you will. So I think that the context itself makes us look at something in a way that is much more clear and much more fundamental than, you know, many of the times in the past.
This is why you're a priest. Thank you for the pastoral answer.
Michael, how can people find more about you and what you're up to and the different types of work that you're up to?
Sure. Our website is a great place. It's SFZC, like San Francisco Zen Center, sfzc.org. And there people can find ways to get in touch with people, to find paths of practice, to even practice online. We even have an online Zendo for sitting meditation online. And people can find me at my name, michael.mccord, at sfzc.org, and can ask me more about practice. And if they're in the Bay Area and they want to go to Tassajara or City Center or Green Gulch, we have three temples that host retreats, sits, courses, classes, on most days and most weeks. So, and they can also come to Young Urban Zen in San Francisco.
Yeah. Highly recommend. Thank you so much, Michael, for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks, it's really, Michael. Really great to talk with you.
Wow. Michael McCord. It was really thought provoking for me when he talked about the fact that the person, you know, namely ourselves, who are making these decisions and these plans to go down a spiritual path, is not exactly the same person who's now down that path some time from now. And so we're making these decisions without full knowledge, which is part of the mystery of life that we're called to enter into. And yet we have faith that we are being led down a path that will in some way continue to transform us spiritually. It's also kind of interesting. I mentioned in the intro that this is one of our earlier interviews, and you can tell that we haven't exactly codified some semblance of a structure yet, if you could call it that. So, we're still figuring out that, oh, it's actually a pretty good idea to have someone tell us their spiritual journey and personal life story at the top of the show. So you get to hear us sort of feeling that out for the season. In any case, I hope you really enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Next up, we're going to be talking to Feta DeVries about his experience in Buddhism and his approach as a professor at a Buddhist university in Northern California. Religion to Reality is, of course, a podcast, but not just a podcast. We also meet online for free every first Wednesday of the month for our monthly interfaith gathering. And I would love to see you there. So please, if you'd like to, you could head over to our Substack. You can also subscribe, of course, to our Substack. It's religion2reality.substack.com. And that's where you can find the link to sign up to attend the monthly gathering. Religion to Reality was created and is executive produced by me, Dave Pliske, and is produced and edited by Nick Stropoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources at religion2reality.org. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.